From understanding a global economic crisis to crunching the numbers at the grocery till, she makes it easy and helps keep more money in your wallet. This is For What It's Worth with Rubina Ahmed Haque.
Welcome to this week's episode. I am Rubina Ahmed Haque, and this is For What It's Worth, where we break down big economic stories in bite-sized pieces so that we can all take something from them. You know, sometimes we hear there's this economic report that's coming out and we wonder, how does that really affect me? Sometimes we hear the Bank of Canada is making a decision. How does that really affect me? And that really brings me to the story that I wanted to talk about off the top for the show today. And that is a story from the Bank of Canada. The Bank of Canada right now is trying to consult with the public as to how they would feel about a digital loonie. So this would really replace the need for things like Bitcoin, Ethereum, other digital currencies that we've heard a lot about in the last few years. Now, it wouldn't act the same as Bitcoin, as an example, but what it would do is that it would create a situation where you would not have to carry cash in your wallet. You would have a digital loonie on a card or on your smartphone that you could use like cash. So there would be no transaction at a bank. So you know when you take 20 bucks out of the bank and you put it into your wallet, it's not earning any interest. And when you spend it, you can spend it anonymously, right? You could go and just buy something for $20 at wherever you need to. And there's no transaction there. All they do is just take your money and give you the product or the service. So it would act in the same way. Now, a lot of experts are saying that this is not really necessary. Only 20% of transactions in Canada right now are actually done in cash. So many of us have now moved to digital transactions anyways. So whether it's a credit card or a debit card or a prepaid card. Now, the only difference is that there is obviously a record of where we spend that money. Now, that's the question that I have for the Bank of Canada. If I have a digital loonie on my card, are you keeping a record of how I'm spending it? Because a lot of people would like to spend cash maybe in a way where it's anonymous. They don't want anyone to know where they've spent that money. Not for any nefarious reason, but just because they just don't want to. Sometimes, you know, I'll go into a store and they'll say, if you can pay cash, I'll give you 3% off because I don't have to pay the transaction fee. So I pay cash, not because I don't want the bank to know that I didn't spend that money or did or did not spend that money, but it saves me money, it saves them money, and I haven't done anything wrong. I'm still paying taxes, right? But it saves that 3% credit card fee. So that's the one thing I wanted to know. Are they still going to track where that money is spent? There is a very, very slim population, the very, very few people in the Canadian, in Canada that would actually need this because they can't get a bank account or they can't, for whatever reason, get a credit card. So there are some people that would benefit from this, especially maybe if you're new to the country and you've got some cash, but you don't want to walk around with wads of cash. You could use this digital loonie. I'm assuming it would be somewhat safer because if you lost that card, there would be some record of it. So you could use it in a safer way than you could use cash. But they've got these consultations open. If you go to the Bank of Canada website, it has a survey that you can take. You can give your opinion. I definitely am going to give my opinion. I'm a Canadian citizen. I want to sort of give my thoughts as to what a digital loonie may mean for the future. But I think this does indicate that we're headed towards this. I mean, more and more of us are doing everything on our smartphone. I sometimes leave the house. I don't even take my wallet because I've got all my cards already on my phone. I don't need to carry a wallet with me. I don't need to worry about how I'm going to transact. The only issue is that if I spend more than X amount of money, my limit, then they want the actual credit card to put in and put the PIN code in. So this could be another step in that direction where we don't really need to carry a lot of things with us when we leave the house. And I like that. I'm not a huge fan of even carrying a purse. I like to just leave with some. Even before I had the credit cards loaded onto my phone, I used to just put the credit card in my back pocket or my front pocket, zip it up and go out and do my shopping. Unless I was driving, I didn't really feel the need to carry my driver's license and all that stuff with me. And this is just going to bring us towards, you know, a more minimalist lifestyle, which I love. But it'll be interesting to see what Canadians say about this digital loonie. Are they going to respond to it in a way that they like the idea? Or are they going to say, you know what, it's not necessary right now. Why are you making us carry, you know, yet another card around? Or why are you taking us away from carrying cash? Because cash is something that sort of represents tradition and the way that we used to spend money. And a lot of people don't like to break that. So there are definitely positives of it where, you know, it will be something where it will minimize how many things we have to carry around. But the negatives are, you know, really that we already use many forms of digital forms of payment, credit cards and debit cards. And so this may not really actually be needed right now. This may not be something that any of us have a need for. And on top of everything else, you don't earn any interest on the money that's on that card. It's just like taking cash out of the bank machine. It's in your wallet. It's not earning any interest. It's actually being devalued as inflation continues to tick higher. $20 last year is worth less this year if you kept it in your wallet. So that's something to think about. And if you have time, go to the Bank of Canada website and fill that survey out. We have a great show for you. We're going to start off by talking about the role AI could play in our personal finances in the future. I'm Rubina Ahmed-Huck, and this is For What It's Worth.
You're listening to For What It's Worth with Rubina Ahmed-Huck.
Artificial intelligence will play a role in how we get our financial advice in the future. Rather than a real-life advisor, we may be plugging in our information into a program that will then be able to give us the best advice on how we should be investing our money to reach our future financial goals. For some of us, this may be outside of our comfort zone, but for others, it could break down the barriers that is stopping them from actually pursuing expert money advice. To talk about this, we are joined by Subodh Kumar. He is a professor of statistics, operations, and data science at Temple University in Philadelphia. Hi, Subodh. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
I first wanted to start by asking, does your research look at when you think about technology and disruptions in these industries that we have become so used to in the way that they perform in our lives?
We try to look at how this can solve important business problems in different domains like finance, healthcare, and so on. But at the same time, we also examine and try to understand what kind of problems these new technologies can create and how we can be well prepared to handle those problems before they occur. So it's both sides, the advantages as well as the challenges they bring. We need to be prepared for that.
And a lot of people are afraid of artificial intelligence, of how it's going to take away our jobs or create unnatural connections that we're not supposed to be having. What role right now is AI playing in finance that we may not even be aware of?
So it's already playing a big role both from the consumer side, where different investors can go and take advice from these algorithms, can take suggestions on where to invest, even their trading advice, their automated tools, they can do the job for you. So we have a lot of that already happening in the market. Even finance companies are using that a lot for fraud detection, risk assessment, a lot of customer service and so on. But going to the point of they're taking away job, first of all, I don't think these algorithms are ready to replace financial investors yet. And even when they start encroaching on the job, actually it's a part of human-machine collaboration. So machine can do the job, but then human can do something better than that. And we have seen this again and again. So I don't think we need to worry too much about that. As long as we can retool and reskill the workforce and find the right place where machines can help and where human can help, I think we are in good shape.
Yeah, I think that this fear of AI is actually going to stop people from understanding how it can make their life easier. But it's going to take society a while to get there, especially those who are older, who may not have as much experience with computers and technology. And this just may be too far for them. It may take them some time to actually get there. But could you give us an example of how AI financial advice could help an individual with long-term goals, like saving for retirement or saving for their kids' education?
See, one best example you can think is that these algorithms can look at things that sometimes the human can miss. because they have capability to look at wide variety of data, not only your own data, but from variety of sources and put all of them together. For example, if an investor is doing something and if they look at lot of data and they find somebody else in the similar situation, what worked for them, what did not work for them, and start putting it together, it can really help people. So basically, since these algorithms have access to all this information from variety of sources as well as lot of information, they can start giving solutions which human or personal advisors cannot give because they might not have access to those scenarios. So we can think of many such scenarios where algorithms can perform equal or even better than human. But at the same time, it's not always true, but we can find many such scenarios because of good algorithms, good computational capabilities, and a wide and large access to the data with a wide variety of data.
Now, in the previous answer, I remember you said financial advisors have not been replaced by AI yet, that keyword yet. Is there concern, if someone is using AI exclusively to get all their money management expert advice, are there any concerns that you see if someone's exclusively using just technology to manage their money?
People are using, but there are two things here. First, the percentage of people who are just relying on technology without any human involvement is still not very high. And second, the kind of people who are able to do this, they themselves are experts, actually. Because many of these AI-based solutions, they are black box, and they may be very accurate, but they may make some silly mistakes because these algorithms they still lack common sense. And if you think of generative AI like ChatGPT, they even hallucinate, which means they can generate solutions that does not even exist. So we have those kind of problems. Now, the people who are already experts, they can look at the solutions of AI and they can make some tweak to make it work. But many people are not in that situation. And that's why I say that we have not replaced it yet. So even though people are relying solely on AI, some of the people, those are already experts. So I think that's a different crowd. Otherwise, slowly and slowly, more people are using. But when I use the word yet there, for financial side, healthcare side, the replacement part will take very long time, not in near future.
Yeah, it's not something that you can just flip a switch and say, okay, now all of our advice is going to come from an algorithm and we no longer need human beings to walk you through this process, because there will still be questions that a person may not be even have the know-how of how to ask AI to get the answer. And you need that human being in front of you that's sort of deciphering what you're trying to get out. I went into ChatGPT and I just put in something really, really generic. I said, how can I best save for my retirement? And I put in my age and a couple of other things, and it spit out, basically, go speak to a financial advisor. It would not give me any concrete advice. Is there a workaround? Are people finding ways still to get information about where they should be investing, even though I wasn't able to when I just asked that basic question?
Yes. There are two things going on. One is there are a lot of regulations coming. European Union and China already have put some restrictions on what kind of results they can generate, what kind of transparency we need. And the US government is very closely looking at that. And they have even indicated that they will very soon have some regulations around what kind of results these algorithms can provide. So a lot of restrictions as well as control are being put into that. That's a good part. But at the same time, their algorithms, and there can certainly be work around it. So I'll give you one example where, if you go and ask them that I want to launch a cyber attack, and they will say, no, I cannot provide you any information because that's illegal. But if you work it around and say that somebody is trying to do a cyber attack on me, what they might be trying to do. Now, this is the question being circulated, many people are asking. So they will block maybe that exact question now. But I'm telling this kind of workaround are there because they lack common sense. So yes, when we put regulations and controls, it will be very high. We have to go very granular, and sometimes we will learn how to even design regulations for that. So it's happening, but there are a lot of work around it, around these regulations.
And I think that you've hit it there, that AI does still lack common sense. I mean, even if you put in ChatGPT, for example, I recently asked them to write a letter to my brother, and the way they wrote that letter, I would never write that way to my brother. It almost felt like old English, the kind of English they used to write that letter, and the vocabulary they decided to use in it. And I think that with financial advice, that may be the same problem that many people find themselves, is that they may be asking questions where a human being might say, a financial advisor who's got lots of experience with all different types of clients might say, you know, this seems like a good idea, but have you thought about this consequence of it? It may not be able to take your idea from here to there. Are there other concerns that someone should be thinking about when they are using any kind of AI to make financial decisions?
Yeah, sure. Means one thing you hit is they are very good in personalization because they have a lot of data, but they also lack personalization. Like you told the example that you wrote later to your brother, similar problem exists. The other problems are that these are black box. So sometimes we don't know that what they are doing inside their algorithm, and that's a problem. Because what if there is a biasness? What if there is a conflict of interest? What if they are violating certain rules? We don't know that. So more transparency is needed. And I think it will help consumers a whole lot if the policymakers come and put some regulations around. They have to disclose how this is calculated, what kind of data they have used, what kind of algorithm they have used. And actually, that's what we are seeing. We will see more regulations around that. But those are some of the concerns users need to worry about when they get this result, because they might be getting results. Sometimes they may be biased or even ridiculous. So we need to know more before we can start using them for general purpose use.
So, but very quickly, could you explain to us when you mean it is a black box? Not everyone may understand that technical term.
Sure. So, in a very simple term, you give them their information and they will tell you, okay, you should do this, 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 and this. Okay. Now you don't know what happened inside that. They took your data. Did they match with some other people's data? Did they just look at which kind of investments have worked well or which will work in your scenario? Means you don't know how much they have even utilized your data, and they just gave something very generic, or they really went inside your understanding, what are your needs, what you want to achieve, what are your goals, and they have given it for you. You have no idea about that. You just get the final result and you don't know the underlying process. That's the black box I'm talking about.
And I think that's very important for people to understand when they are using the information they're getting from AI in their everyday life, that they know that there is limitations as to what kind of information you can get. So, but this has been a very interesting conversation. I think this is just the beginning of us talking about the role AI will play in personal finance, because all that data is very difficult for any human being to take and make sense of. But with AI, we may be able to find solutions that can help people make better investment decisions, which would be great, especially for retail investors. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bye. That's Subodh Kumar. He is a professor of statistics, operations, and data science at Temple University in Philadelphia, talking to us about the role AI could play in our personal finances. When we come back, we're going to talk more about money. I'm Rubina Ahmed-Haq, and this is For What It's Worth.
You're listening to For What It's Worth with Rubina Ahmed-Haq.
A new report shows almost half of Canadian workers are feeling overwhelmed by their debt. It was conducted by TELUS Health. It's their financial well-being report, and it shows more than ever we're just feeling really uncertain about our financial future. If this is something that you're feeling, my next guest is here to help you out with some practical tips to manage that debt and to stop feeling so overwhelmed by it. Taz Rajan is a community engagement partner at Bromwich and Smith, a licensed insolvency trustee, and she joins me now. Welcome to the program, Taz.
Thank you so much for having me, Ruby.
So the first thing I wanted to ask you is just your reaction to this TELUS Health report that says one out of two of us, so basically half of us, are feeling overwhelmed by the amount of debt that we're carrying.
Yeah, well, I don't think it should be surprising to anyone. I mean, you look at inflation, you know, in June, inflation peaked at 8.1%, which is literally the highest we've seen inflation since the 80s. And I don't know about you or some of your listeners, but I remember my dad telling me stories about, you know, in the 80s, people were selling their home for a dollar. So of course, half of us are feeling that overwhelm and that stress. You think about over COVID, many of us were not working, didn't have work, didn't have income maybe coming in for our businesses, but we were just holding on. I think that's what a lot of us Canadians did. We were just sort of like barely holding on by our nails and just we're so optimistic and we think that things are going to get better. But as we start to come out, you know, we're starting to see creditors take action now. We're seeing CRA take action, you know, on anyone who took CERB payments or some of those other things. Obviously, at Bromwich and Smith, we've really seen, you know, insolvencies rise right across Canada. Actually, it's not necessarily even province specific. So, you know, it is a little bit of the sign of the times. I want to say, though, these financial cycles are just that. They're cycles. This too shall pass. But, you know, it's not surprising. And if you're someone listening today that's starting to feel overwhelmed, like, I hope there's a little bit of solace there going, hey, one in two other people are feeling this way. I'm not alone.
So let's get into it. If someone is feeling like, okay, I am one of those people, I feel overwhelmed, I'm not sleeping well at night because all I can think about is the credit card bill is due, the property taxes are due, I still owe money to someone I borrowed from to pay my last month's bill, and that can create a lot of anxiety that spills over into our work, into our relationships. What's step one if you're feeling that way?
Yeah, for sure. And it really does, like, finances and emotions, our mental and physical health are completely tied. So step number one is just to acknowledge it within yourself, even just to sort of stop and go, whoa, what's this pit in my stomach? Or, you know, what is this feeling that I'm having? And just even to acknowledge it is step number one. Step number two, and, you know, again, we know statistically most Canadians don't actually do or have a budget or like really work through any sort of a budgeting app. But really, truly, a budget, to me, that's your ticket to freedom. Having a budget is just knowing how much money is coming in each month, how much money is going out each month. And for me, it's a very empowering tool. Just see it as a tool and nothing else. It's a tool to see. It's sometimes, for, you know, it'll help with that anxiety, because sometimes anxiety is just all these thoughts we have in our mind. We haven't gotten anything down on paper. And a lot of those fears we have, or a lot of that anxiety, is not based on fact. So when you actually have a budget, you've written down, this was my paycheck, this was rent, this was groceries, you know, whatever that was, it's fact-based now. And that alone can relieve a lot of that stress or pressure as well. If when you do that budget and you're seeing that more money is going out than coming in and you're starting to feel overwhelmed, you know, take that step of having a conversation with a professional. And we can look at all sorts of different things, right? There's not just reducing the money going out. There's also ways to increase the money coming in. There's ways to look at, you know, dealing with that debt and maybe getting it taken care of. And then step number three is just acknowledging that you are not alone and it is not the end of, you know, your financial life. You can and will be able to thrive again after you deal with that overwhelming debt that you're feeling.
And you speak from experience, because you've been through this whole situation and you are now doing much better, working now to help others with their finances. Talk to me a little bit about your experience with debt and that feeling of just being overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've been in the finance industry most of my adult life. And of course, you know, you think about when you're a child and you play bankruptcy, I mean, you play Monopoly, as soon as you hit bankruptcy, it's like game over, right? So obviously, having been in finance, this idea of being overwhelmed by debt and, you know, insolvency has always been this really big no-no, a very taboo. But I was working 100% commission position, living off of my savings and waiting for, you know, the pay to come in. You know, I didn't have any benefits and I was rear-ended. And that's, you know, we see quite often in the work that we do is it's these external factors like an accident, you know, job loss, some sort of critical illness or disability or divorce or death of a spouse. These are these external triggers that can really take us from, you know, juggling our debt to feeling completely overwhelmed by our debt. So I had a really bad concussion. I could barely sit up. I could not work. There was no income coming in, but the bills continue. And for me, I had a very large Canada Revenue debt that was not going away and the interest was just piling up. And so, yeah, did I ever feel alone? I really, truly, in that moment, I felt like nobody else does this, which logically makes no sense, right? There would not be options for debt if nobody else ever struggled with it. But in that moment, I did feel like, you know, I'm the failure. I'm a loser. Nobody else is going through this. You know, how could I make such a huge mistake? How could I be in such a terrible position? And I mean, honestly, it was not necessarily through my own fault, but we do feel that. And there's so much stigma and shame around it. We don't tend to talk about it with other people. Of course, now I always talk about it. And you would be so surprised at how many people I talk to that are like, oh, I did bankruptcy too, or I went through a consumer proposal too. And we're all thriving today. You know, I have the highest credit score I've ever had in my life because I dealt with the problem. I dealt with the issue and, you know, have learned and grown since that. And it's such a passion project for me to be able to help other people do the same.
Because we often talk anecdotally, you know, we're saving for that emergency, that leaky roof or job loss, but you live through it and you know exactly what that can do very quickly to your finances and how much debt can pile up and then it can exacerbate other things that may be happening in your life and just make those things worse. A lot of debt comes from lifestyle choices. So things that we decide, the car we decide to buy, where we want to live. What can we do when it comes to our lifestyle? What changes can we make that don't feel like we're depriving ourselves of something, but can really save a lot of money for a person who's trying to get out of debt?
Yeah, definitely. I am definitely not a joy kill. And I'm not a proponent of, you know, some of the other kind of gurus that are out there that say give up everything and live on
give
nothing.
Give up your coffee, live give up your coffee. Yeah, exactly.
Never go shopping. It's just, it's not sustainable. And it's not realistic. And this is where, honestly, I know I sound like a bit of a broken record, I know, but I'm going back to the budget because you look at your budget and you determine. I have a friend who, you know, when he was asked, how much do you spend at Starbucks? He's got two girls. They were in all these different activities. He's like, I think $75 a month. Goes and does his budget. And it's actually $400 a month. This was kind of their in between school and activity. This is where they would eat basically. And realizing that does not necessarily mean no more Starbucks. It means, hey, you need to adjust your budget. You're actually spending $400. And I mean, I'm just using one example. It could be at any store. But now just adjust your budget. If that's a non-negotiable, listen, making meals at home, we don't have time for that. We're going to be doing this. Okay, now you've got to adjust something else. So I think it's very individual, very personalized. Look at your budget as this living document and figure out what are your values? What are the non-negotiables? And then where are the areas that you can make some adjustments, right? And if cutting back is not an option, you've got to look at ways of increasing income. And the other thing I want to say is, you know, a lot of people are like one or the other. You can be paying off debt and getting in a better financial situation while you are saving for that emergency, while you are saving for your retirement or your mortgage or whatever that may be. You know, doing both at the same time, I think, is really going to create that momentum. And it gives you something to look forward to as well. So that when you take away maybe whatever, driving your car three times a week, you've got your eye on the prize. And you're like, I know that I get to buy that gorgeous purse at the end of 3 months, because I gave up my car for 3 days.
And you've mentioned a couple of times, Taz, increasing income. That seems like a lofty idea. You know, I'll just make more money. But for so many people, we don't have the time, we don't have the resources, and we just don't have We just don't know how even to make that happen. How can someone increase their income if, say, they're a full-time salaried employee and they've got kids and other things happening in their life where they just don't have the time to do it?
Yeah, I think, honestly, we're living in the best age and time for that. We have, you know, Facebook Marketplace, Craigslist, all of those kinds of places. So springtime is a great time to maybe declutter your household and even sell a few things on Marketplace or some of these other areas. You can get the kids involved as well. A lot of them are on spring break or they'll be on summer break. So even getting the kids involved in, you know, are they artsy? Can they sell something or can they babysit or, you know, can they sell their old, you know, sporting equipment? So that's one way for sure. So many side gigs and side hustle and, you know, business opportunities out there. My one caution on that is you've got to go in eyes wide open. You've got to make sure that it's legitimate. And that, you know, you are going to be on the upside of things. You know, a lot of people do come to us because they started a side hustle and it actually put them upside down. But I think there's a lot of different ways you can look at cash back options as well. So, you know, there's different apps for that. There's different banking opportunities. There's like switching your shopping to places where you're getting the cash back. And honestly, increasing income is one side of that balance sheet. So, I mean, we do need to also reduce some of those budgetary items that maybe, you know, aren't moving us closer to our goals as well.
Taz, it's been so great talking to you. I know that I got a lot out of this conversation. I know our listeners will as well. Just knowing that there is hope when you are feeling overwhelmed, and you are a living, breathing example of that, of someone who's been through it and is doing well on the other side. So I think that's really inspiring to hear. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Taz Rajan is a community engagement partner at Bromwich & Smith. It's a licensed insolvency trustee. When we come back, are you upset with how expensive it's getting to see your favorite performer live in concert? Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about how to actually afford these concerts and what you can be doing proactively to save a little bit of money when you actually go see your favorite artist in person. I'm Rubina Ahmed Haque, and this is For What It's Worth.
You're listening to For What It's Worth with Rubina Ahmed Haque.
That brings us to the end of the program. I really hope you got something out of our guests today. I really enjoyed that conversation with Subodh Kumar, the professor of statistics at Temple University in Philadelphia, talking about the role AI is going to play in our personal finances in the future. Now, I'm not afraid of technology, but I know that there is a lot of concern, and I agree with that concern, that if you ask a computer a question and it gives you some advice, is following it the right thing to do? I mean, this is true with our health as well. Would you really want to go in and say, I've got this kind of rash and this much fever, and I have been eating this kind of food. What do you think I have? And it spits out an answer as to what you might be sick with. You really want to see a doctor who's going to see you with their eyes and all the knowledge they have. They're going to use that to diagnose what's actually going on with you and then critically think what else could be happening and send you for some further tests. So that's the same with personal finance. You may go in there and say, I'm 25 years old. I want to save for retirement. I make $70,000 a year. This is my risk tolerance. What should I be doing? And it gives you some advice. And like he said, you know, they only have the information that's available to them. So you don't necessarily have the privilege of speaking to someone who's had different clients, different situations where they've had these soft conversations with people and help them walk through some of their anxieties, where a young person might go and say, I want to be super conservative with my investments. And ChatGPT, for example, says, okay, here's what you should be doing. Whereas a financial advisor might say, listen, you're 25 years old. You can take some risk. You can actually, within the 40 years, you know, in the first 20 years or so, you can take some risk. You don't have to be so conservative in the way that you're investing your money, and then explain to them what they mean by that. So that's the part of it that you will be missing if you exclusively use AI right now to get your personal finance advice. I think that there is definitely a marriage of the two where you can get information. They can really go out into the world and gather a bunch of information from all that data that's out there and give you, you know, this is the stock that did the best this year across the globe, or this is the industry that did the worst this year because of whatever is happening in Europe or in Africa or any other place in the world. It can give you some really sort of data-based information, but that soft skill of really understanding your client, it still isn't there yet. Like the professor said, it doesn't have common sense. And if you ask, for example, ChatGPT to write you something, it does write in a way that doesn't really jive with how we write in our everyday life. I know that for me, it wrote, I would never write in the way that it wrote a letter that I tried to write to my brother. First of all, it started off, dear brother. I don't think I've ever said that in my whole life. It didn't understand that that is not the way that I would speak. So there is definitely limitations, but really interesting to see AI enter into the financial space. It's already there. Like the professor was saying, it's already checking for things like fraud. And when, for example, when we filed all our tax returns just a month ago, it was AI that was assessing all of those returns in the front end. And then later, if they found something that needed further investigation, a human being would go in there and take a deeper look as to what it thinks maybe needs attention. So AI is already playing a role in our finances, in our taxes, in our everyday money lives. But when it comes to our investments, our retirement savings, our kids' education, money we're saving for a down payment on a house, it's really important to seek out the advice of a financial advisor who can really work with you as a personality, as a person, as a human being to help get to your money goals rather than as a data point. You fit this situation, this is the best situation for you. That's really, I don't think, the best way to manage your money at this point in time. May get better. It may get a lot better, and we may be having a different conversation in a few years. But right now, there really does need to be a balance between using a person and using a robot to get that financial advice. Before I let you go, I want to talk about something that I know has affected a lot of young people, and that is the cost of tickets to see your favorite performer, like Taylor Swift. A lot of criticism has been lauded at Live Nation, who owns Ticketmaster, at the cost of buying tickets online and even access to those tickets. If you are lucky enough to actually buy one, there's service fees and handling fees and taxes and everything that adds up to a lot more than people can afford to go see someone like Taylor Swift or The Weeknd or The Cure, these big bands that we get, especially in big cities like Toronto, Vancouver, and Calgary, Montreal, that we love and enjoy their music, but buying the tickets to see them just seems financially out of reach. A new company called Sidedoor, which is run by a Juno-winning musician, Dan Mangan, and his partner, Laura Simpson, they have started this company to really give live music a chance to be more affordable. They're offering musicians more accessible and affordable places to perform, giving them an alternative when it comes to using the music promoter monopoly, as they call it. So rather than going to the big stadiums and having to deal with all the expenses, they're giving them alternative ways to actually put on their show. Now, they may not get the Taylor Swift type of artists, but they definitely will attract some musicians that want to keep their ticket prices low and still make some money. Because the other criticism is that the actual artists don't really make all that much. Most of the money is made by the venue because they own the venue, they own the merchandise, they own the concession stands, and all of that money goes into their pockets. And so the artists that you're going to see, the money that you're spending to see them, most of it isn't going towards them in the end. A lot of that is going towards paying for other things in that big stadium. So they want to make live music more accessible. Just a couple of tips before I let you go. If you are going to see a big performance and you have spent hundreds of dollars in order to afford it, just a couple of things that you can do just to keep your costs down. I mean, number one would be do not buy resale tickets. You're going to spend more money from one of those resale sites because they're a lot more than the fair value of that ticket when it was first purchased. If you can, and this is a hard sell, focus on less popular acts. So don't go see Taylor Swift. Go see a local band in your own city, in your own town. You're still getting that live music experience, but without the big ticket costs. And often they're much more accessible where you can show up, 10, 15 minutes before the show starts, and there's not as much stress involved with going to see that kind of concert as well. Don't buy any expensive merchandise or concessions when you are watching that concert, because those are very overpriced, especially the merchandise. You can still get it after the fact online or from different venues. That's going to cost you a lot less. And if you have the time and the resources, consider going to another city to see the same act. So if you live in a big city like Toronto, consider if that same artist is going to Buffalo, because you can see that same act sometimes in a smaller town for a little bit less and a lot less stress too, right? Getting into a city like Toronto, getting into the Air Canada Center or the Rogers Center takes a lot of effort, takes a lot of time. It might be less stressful to go to a smaller town to see the same act. So that's just some personal finance saving tips when it comes to seeing your favorite act in concert. Thank you so much to all of you for listening today. Thank you to Bilal Masri, our technical producer, for putting the show together. We will be back next week, same time, same channel. I'm Rubina Madhak, and this is For What It's Worth.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.